What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. This is Resistance in Residence, where we profile artists using their gifts to change the world. Our Resistance in Residence artists, plural, this week are children's authors Sarah and Ian Hoffman. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having us back on the show. We're thrilled.
Really excited to have you both here. Just going to start with a little bit about you, Sarah, and then Ian, you can ponder on this because I'm going to ask you the exact same question. Sarah, where and how did you grow up? What was your family like?
I'm from Los Angeles. I am an only child. I grew up with divorced parents, both of whom were pretty progressive, generally good values in my home, you know, introduced to all different kinds of people from an early age.
I grew up in upstate New York in one of those areas that's 60% Republican and 40% Democrat. So sort of a good mixture. And I've got a large family, a lot of siblings, and my parents were not especially politically involved, but we did discuss issues all the time.
And Sarah, when did you discover the world of writing?
Well, I wanted to be a writer when I was a kid. Apparently, my grandmother asked me when I was 2 what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I said, Grandma, I am an artist. And I started writing in journals when I was 15, right after my father died, and I didn't have a ton of support. And just journal writing became very important. I discovered writing more in college. I went into an unrelated field. And actually, when I broke my foot and was on the couch for 6 weeks, and I was like, this is it. This is when I'm going to start my writing career. And I did. I wrote a piece that got accepted by the San Francisco Chronicle, and I started writing for an adult audience. And that's how I got into it. And then when our son presented us with some unexpected opportunities, and we were thinking a lot about kids and gender, I started writing about that for adults. And that became sort of a mini side career, not our day job situation.
Ian, what about you?
I grew up as a big reader, but I was an artist. I have no memories that predate learning how to draw. And I didn't think I would be a writer. And I didn't really start writing until I was an adult. And children's books with their illustrations were sort of a natural way for me to get into writing.
Oh, you wrote that children's book for our niece.
Right. Yeah. That was the first one I did.
That was the first one.
And when or how did you all end up writing together?
We've been working together on various projects, including our day jobs, since we've known each other pretty much. And so writing was a natural segue from the other work that we were doing together.
So I was doing this writing about gender for adults, and Ian was writing children's picture books on unrelated topics. And one day we were like, we could do this together. And we really saw a need because it means a lot to a kid to be able to see themselves reflected in a book. And so when our son was little and he was this quirky guy who wanted to wear a dress and he wasn't like any of the other kids that he knew. And so we looked around for books about kids like him to support him, and there were not any. So that was the impetus for our first book together, which is Jacob's New Dress.
So you got Jacob's address, and then you have Jacob's room to choose.
Yes, and two more.
We also have Jacob's school play starring he, she, and they. And our newest one is Jacob's missing book, which is about book banning from a kid's eye point of view.
And all of those things are a good segue into what we are about to dip into now. So you all first came on the show because we were reporting about a lawsuit that one of your books is named in, and that is Mahmood versus Taylor. And Ian, I'm wondering if you can just talk about what the lawsuit is, and then we'll get into why it's so problematic.
Sure. So I'll try and make this brief. In Montgomery County, Maryland, which is the largest county there, which is a diverse community, the school realized that there was not a lot of LGBTQ representation in the books that were available for the elementary school kids, despite the fact that they have a lot of LGBTQ families. And so about 3 years ago, they went through this process of, okay, how do we introduce some picture books that are available for kids to read. And they asked the teachers and the librarians, they, you know, vetted it before the parents, and they put these 9 books into the classrooms. And they were there, and some religious parents wanted to opt their kids out of being exposed to this content. And that, through a series of steps, led to the school saying, "This, we can't do this." And the parents took the school district to court and lost. And they took the school district to an appeals court, where they lost again. And then they appealed to the Supreme Court, who remarkably decided that they needed to hear this case.
Remarkable, because 2 lower courts had said, look, there's no harm here. These children are not being coerced to believe the things in these books. They're just sitting in their classroom available for impromptu read-alouds or paging through them themselves, you know, just to represent the families that actually exist in that district.
Ian, when you... the way you describe it, it makes it sound so benign, right? They just wanted to opt their, their kids out of, you know, having to read the book. I mean, if someone was not grounded in politics, right, they could very easily say, well, what's wrong with that? Ian, let's talk about what's wrong with that, or what's problematic about that, or challenging about that, however you choose to phrase it.
Sure. So this is book banning by another name. Book banning is very unpopular in the United States. About 70% of Americans are against it, but the right is all for it, especially the Christian right. And so this is another avenue that they're exploring in order to get books banned, because the actual, it sounds like, oh yeah, I should be able to opt my kid out of something I don't want them to see. That's a very reasonable argument. But the how that plays out on the ground is not at all reasonable. I mean, how are you going to opt your kid out of evolution in biology class? How are you going to opt your kid out of any number of subjects that somebody's going to be unhappy with for religious reasons? And, you know, that includes women working outside of the home. Or just as a thought experiment, let's say your religion says that races shouldn't mix, and so you want to opt your kid out of anything that has to do with Black people in it. You know, let's say Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks or anybody. And so how is this, is that a good idea for the school district and for the people in the school district? Because really part of a public school education is learning to get along with people who are different than you. And B, how is a teacher going to be able to teach a classroom of, you know, 30 children when they have to be aware of what child needs to be opted out of what subject?
And it completely makes impossible any kind of impromptu discussion. So a lot of how teachers teach and how these books are being used in the district is a subject comes up and the teacher says, oh, we have a book for that. And they go and get it and they read it to the class. But opt-outs require generally a 2-week notice period. So are you going to say, oh, I have a book for that, but let me notify all of your parents? And we'll talk about that in 2 weeks with those of you who are allowed to stay in the room.
There's also the practicality of, we're talking about kindergartners, first graders, second graders. What do you do with those children when they need to be opted out of a lesson? You know, you can't just send them to the cafeteria. They need supervision. Do their parents come and get them for the day? In which case, the child's missing a day of school, and how do you teach the rest of the curriculum?
Right, for the 8 minutes that this book is shared.
Exactly.
Whatever book is shared.
And then there's the impact on the kids themselves, right? Either who come from homes where there's LGBTQ plus representation, you know, parents, siblings, what have you. And or as I believe I'm remembering was the case with your son and actual experiences on campus, to then see the school say, you're right, nobody has to learn about me or my family. What kind of impact does that have on a kid?
It's terrible. I mean, what kind of a message does that say to somebody that, like, oh, 5 people in the classroom are leaving the classroom because we're talking about a book that has a family in it that's like my family?
Yeah, and the school district, to its credit, recognized that not only is this logistically impossible to coordinate these opt-outs, but that it's offensive and isolating to these children who either feel that they are represented by these books or their families are represented by these books. And it's one of the things that we brought into Jacob's missing book. We have a character named Emily who has 2 dads, and a book disappears from their classroom, which is, the book is Entango Makes 3, which, despite being both nonfiction and about penguins, is one of the most banned picture books in our country. And so this book, it's not named in the book, but it's it's obviously this book to people who've read this gorgeous picture book. And the book is missing. And the teacher says, we're not going to be able to read that book anymore because some people were upset about it. And it comes out that, you know, that the penguin has two dads in the book. And Emily says, what's wrong with having two dads? And so we wanted to show in real time what it's like for a kid who is given this message by, right? So our books are about kindness and acceptance. And this is the opposite. When you remove these books, this is about isolation and alienation and shaming just for someone's own identity.
Ian, you mentioned, or Sarah, you feel free to pick this up. You mentioned that there was a process that the school went through to put these books into the curriculum, which included talking to parents. Where were these parents that have brought not one, not two, but three attempts to use the courts to overrule the decision of the school? Where were they then? Was there noise then, or did this just pop up once the decision had been made?
There wasn't noise then, and we haven't heard anything about that. We did talk to a school board member from Montgomery County and a children's book librarian from Montgomery County. And what they've told us is that most of the parents who are objecting to these books aren't objecting to them on the basis of religious freedom. They're objecting to them because they've been told that they contain sexual content.
Yeah, we talked to a parent who brought her child to the protest on the day of the hearing. She's a kindergartner in Montgomery County, and it was very sweet. She told us, she said, this is Jack. And there was Jack wearing a dress. And she said, we love Jacob's new dress. It's a, you know, huge book in our house. And she said that while a couple of the parents did have religious grounds objections, that the majority of the complaints from parents were that they were teaching sex to kindergartners. And where does that idea come out? It comes out in right-wing media. So because these books are about kindness and acceptance, and it's just not a great look to say, we're against kindness and acceptance, they have to lie about the content. They don't have to. Their choice is to lie about the content of these books and say, we are teaching sex to kindergartners. These books are pornographic. And so, of course, parents are going to say, I don't want my child exposed to that. That's perfectly a reasonable thing, but that's just not what's happening. So I think what happens in all these instances of book bans, and this, of course, is the most high profile one, but this happens in thousands of cities and towns across our country all the time, is that parents are being told by organized groups like Moms for Liberty, these organized right-wing groups, that these books are harming their children. And so they are having a normal human response, which is, I want to protect my child. But unfortunately, they are operating on false information.
It's been our experience that the overwhelming majority of people who object to our books have not read them. And yeah. It's very evident that they haven't read them because of the things that they claim that are in the books. And just listening to the Supreme Court justices talk about our books, two of them claimed to have read them, Gorsuch and Alito, and clearly had not read them.
Well, or they read them and they wanted to lie about their content, but they're Supreme Court justices. So instead of lying, they threw out words. For example, was it Gorsuch who was obsessed with Pride Puppy?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So Gorsuch said, this book, Pride Puppy, what is this about? Like sex workers and bondage. And Ketanji Brown Jackson, was it Ketanji Brown Jackson? It was Amy Coney Barrett. Oh my God. Amy Coney Barrett, our savior in that moment. She said, no, it wasn't a sex worker. It was a drag queen. Like when you're having to have your content saved by Amy Coney Barrett. Anyway, so he misrepresented it in this way that was not technically a lie. And people are saying, did he not understand the book? Did he lie about reading it? No, he knew perfectly well what was in that book. But just like Fox News, he wanted to throw out these phrases that would get people riled up, at the same time protect himself from accusations of an actual lie.
And I think all of what you just said is absolutely true. And also, we know that transgender folks, folks that dress in drag, are often equated in a negative connotation with things that the right finds reprehensible, like sex work. So like perhaps a combination of all of those things were true as that stuff came out of his mouth.
Yes.
Yes.
Which is, yeah.
Yes.
Go ahead.
And but it's not up to us to speculate on what his motivations are, but we can expect, we can see what the effect is going to be if they allow these opt-outs to happen.
Well, and,
yeah.
Go ahead, sir.
And that, so that, you know, I...
Can I just talk about that for a second?
Yeah, sure.
The effect of this is, you know, if they allow this kind of opt-out, then they have to allow religious opt-outs on a whole range of things. And this becomes a national issue. And so these books will disappear from classrooms across the country.
This came out on the day of the hearing. Jackson was saying if a teacher who is a lesbian has a photo of herself and her wife on her desk at their wedding, is that something the children are no longer allowed to be exposed to? If a transgender child asks to be used by certain pronouns, are they allowed to not use those pronouns? I mean, it's not just about books. And it is, as Ian said, on such a broad range of topics and topics which matter to the court, such as women working outside the home, which is has been a religious objection that has attempted to come to the Supreme Court in the past. They have declined to hear. And now this case, depending on how it goes, opens up the pathway to make those kinds of objections and try and opt your children out of a book where a mother works.
Ian or Sarah, you all decide who takes this one. I mean, when this process started, we were not in the first 100 plus a few days of the Trump administration, who has been using vengeance and federal funding and all sorts of other tactics to ensure that folks are moving along with his oppressive agenda. But say what you just said, but inside of our current political context. Like, how much higher are the stakes now?
Let's go back a little bit to Florida's Don't Say Gay bill, which is 2022, I think. And so Florida modeled how you could pass laws that would restrict this kind of content. And it seemed very extreme at the time. And they've had some victories in court and they've had some losses in court. And it's taken many years for that bill to make its way through the court process. And in the meantime, other states have taken up those same restrictions on content that are being taught to students. And so it was sort of working its way through the system. Can states make those kinds of restrictions? And then we get to the current administration and it's super powered.
So when we were in DC for the hearing, we went by the Holocaust Museum. And we'd been there before in the past. And as Jews, we have received this kind of education, seeing these images, you know, our entire lives. We started learning about the Holocaust when we were 5 years old in Hebrew school. But I was really struck this time by something that I really had failed to take in the past when seeing this particular museum. The way the museum is set up, they have different floors for different portions of history. And so the first floor that you go to, which is the fourth floor, is entirely dedicated to the pre-war period. And what I saw is that everything that the Nazis and even the pre-Nazis did are things we are doing now. So silencing artists and dissidents and media and quietly building, well, they were building concentration camps in Poland. We have built them in El Salvador. And it was chilling to realize that this period before the war, which I just never really paid attention to, is exactly where we are right now. And I looked at the photos of the Nazis burning books and I thought, okay, so we got it. We got that message. Burning books is not popular. So we're going to ban books. So we did that for some time. And now the right wing in our country knows that banning books is unpopular. And so now they have pivoted again. They're very good at rhetoric. They are now calling it parental rights and religious freedom, which are the two phrases that come up in Mahmoud v. Taylor. And they're using this sort of innocuous sounding language to, in this case, erase queer identities. But it's all part of a much broader agenda that I'm glad you put it in this bigger political context, because that is exactly where we are. And I realize that we are at the point in history where the next step is state-sanctioned violence against all the communities that this administration is seeking to erase.
I mean, to your point, right? Like, we're coming to a place where it will be state-sanctioned violence against all our communities. I think we've been there for a really long time. I think we've been there under different names. I mean, the work I do outside of here, as yes. I run the Anti-Police yeah. Terror Project, and state-sanctioned murders of Black folks forever and always. Mm-hmm. We know that particularly when you intersect, right, trans, queer, gay, lesbian bodies with Blackness or brownness or disability, right, that the state kills them at even higher rates. And so I when I talk about impact, and again, this is for either of you to take, something I also explore on this show often is the way in which policy and practice can often turn to tangible, egregious, and horrific outcomes for folks that are differently bodied, differently abled, differently gendered, whatever, alternatively gendered, Black, brown, et cetera, in the world. The assertion that I'm making is these aren't benign policies. In addition to it impacting folks feeling like they belong, self-esteem, et cetera, all things that we know are critical for young people as they're developing, right, into what we hope are whole, healthy, and rounded children. But also, it can often transmute into violence.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. I want to correct what I said before. It's not that the state-sanctioned violence isn't going on, hasn't been going on for some time. I meant to say widespread. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And a perfect example of that was at the Holocaust Memorial, where we saw images that I don't think I'd seen before, actually, of the hospitals where they euthanized children who were physically disabled and, as they said, feeble-minded. And we know about the extermination of, you know, a number of populations. But so I think what's happening is we're seeing what's been going on in particularly marginalized communities spread to even broader communities and spread even more broadly. And I think the next step is, if they succeed, is more mass violence.
When our son was in kindergarten, actually, and wearing a dress to school and had long hair, he had a teacher who came up to us and said, "Do you have any lesson plans for me to help support Sam?" And we said, "No, we don't." And so she came up with lesson plans to help his classmates learn about him and support him, because they were naturally curious and they were mean to him and teased him. You know, there was a lot of, "Are you a boy or a girl? What's going on here?" And so she came up with these lessons on the fly. She'd hear someone say pink is a girl color, and she'd say, she'd stop what she was doing and she'd say, "Is pink a girl color? Like, what are the girl colors and what are the boy colors?" And they would start a whole discussion on colors, which would end with them saying, "Oh, colors are colors. They don't actually belong to one gender or another." And through these little lessons, she got her classroom to support Sam. And they stopped teasing him. They stopped questioning him. And Sam was just Sam. What happened is that there was another kindergarten classroom right next door where that teacher wasn't doing these kinds of lessons for her kids. And so when they all went out on the playground, the kids from the classroom next door teased and questioned Sam a lot, just the way Sam's classmates did before his teacher, Ms. Reeves, did these simple lessons on kindness. And what we learned is that creating a culture of kindness is work, but it's not hard work. And so that's really where we're coming from. Like, how do we create this culture of kindness? And the opposite of the culture of kindness is what we saw, how the other kids treated Sam.
And there's a spectrum from this like little sweet kindergarten moment all the way to violence when we fail to create that culture that welcomes all kinds of difference. And we believe that, and we believe a lot of people believe that part of a public school education is learning to get along with people who are different from you. And so a lot of the policies of this current administration are about division and setting people into their camps. And that is where we start on the spectrum of moving toward violence.
Super powerful answers to that question. I'd like to give you both an opportunity for closing words.
Well, one thing that I would love to say is that, so the book that's before the Supreme Court now in Mahmoud v. Taylor is Jacob's Room to Choose. And a friend asked us last week, what would you say to the plaintiffs if you could talk to them? Something that had never occurred to us. And we started thinking about, well, what are the values of our book? You know, on a basic level, it's that every kid should be able to use the bathroom safely. And also what I just said, that learning to get along with people who are different from you is actually part of a public school education. And what we said at the top, which is that every child should see themselves represented in a book. And our guess is that the parents who are trying to opt their children out of reading our book and the other books in the case, that they believe these same things. So a lot of these divisions that are created are completely artificial. These are basic values that many, many parents share.
Sarah and Ian Hoffman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us and for the work that you do.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA, that's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. Our Resistance in Residence theme music was composed by Jesse Strauss. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listeners. If you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.